From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Robert Reich looks back on his 4 years as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration and tells us what lessons he's learned about politics and how to be a muckety-muck in Washington. And we'll find out why he decided to leave Washington. He's written a new memoir called Locked in the Cabinet. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews In the Gloaming, the new HBO telemovie starring Glenn Close, directed by Christopher Reeve. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. House Speaker Newt Gingrich is getting a loan from Bob Dole to pay the $300,000 he owes for violating House rules. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Gingrich is getting the $300,000 loan from the former Senate Majority Leader, which he's agreed to repay at 10% interest. In a statement, Dole said he considers the loan not only an opportunity to support a friend, but a long-term investment in the future of the Republican Party. Gingrich called Dole a patriot. In a statement, he and his wife Marianne said they decided, whatever the consequences, to do what was best and what was right, morally and spiritually. While Republicans are saying this brings the matter of Gingrich's ethics to a close, Democrats aren't quite ready to concede that. They say the Ethics Committee must now decide whether the terms of the loan Gingrich is receiving from Dole are comparable to what he would get at a bank. They also point out there may be a conflict of interest in taking money from Dole, who has just signed on with a prominent Washington law firm with many clients who have interests before Congress. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Officials in Fargo, North Dakota, are again shoring up dikes along the Red River. It's believed the river is at its highest level in 500 years. Hundreds of city residents have either left home or are getting ready to flee. Some face a second threat of flooding danger from the wild Rice River, which is also rising. South African President Nelson Mandela has issued a formal invitation to ailing Zairean President Mobutu Sese Seko to meet rebel leader Laurent Kabila for talks on ending the crisis in Zaire. Sean Crowley reports from Johannesburg.
Laurent Kabila, who now controls half of Zaire, left South Africa on Thursday after peace talks with President Mandela yesterday. The Zairean government envoy also left South Africa. He carried an official request from Mandela that President Mobutu Sese Seko come to South Africa and negotiate with Kabila as soon as possible. Laurent Kabila has said that talks with Mobutu would only be about negotiating an end to his presidency. Meanwhile, United Nations Special Envoy to Zaire, Mohamed Sanoun, said that South Africa would continue to host discussions between the warring factions until a peaceful solution to the crisis had been found. For National Public Radio, this is Sean Crowley in Johannesburg.
Albania's rival, political parties have agreed to set June 29th as their day for parliamentary elections. The parties hope to end 3 months of civil unrest and anarchy triggered after a pyramid scheme collapsed. Nearly every Albanian lost money. The date was announced by a representative from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has been trying to mediate differences between Albanian groups. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 23 points at 6702. The Nasdaq is up 12 points at 1222. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher for the fourth day in a row. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market continues to be driven by strong earnings news. During the prior three sessions, the Dow gained more than 4%. Today, Lucent Technologies, Dean Witter, and Digital Equipment became the latest to report better-than-expected profit. Computer software issues are higher on expectations for a sterling earnings report from Microsoft at the close of trading today. And airline stocks have advanced after Morgan Stanley raised earnings estimates for Delta and American Airlines. The stock market is also being supported by a drop in long-term interest rates, which occurred on news of slower manufacturing in the Philadelphia region, along with a larger-than-expected increase in the number of first-time jobless claims last week. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says the nation's trade deficit improved in February. The Commerce Department reports the imbalance fell 8% to $11.6 billion. The drop in the red ink was led by increased demand for American-made airplanes and chemicals that pushed U.S. exports to a record high, which in turn offset U.S. demand for imported goods. There are different reports on which way federal regulators will go on the $23 billion planned merger between Bell Atlantic and NYNEX. The Wall Street Journal says both companies are prepared for the Justice Department to nix the idea. But the New York Times reports it's unlikely regulators will block the planned merger. A final decision is expected within a week. Both baby Bells are upbeat publicly about the decision, but the Wall Street Journal reports company attorneys are prepared for a legal counterattack if the merger is blocked by regulators. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's it like for a professor to leave the academy and join the cabinet to serve a president who is also an old friend? That's what Robert Reich's new memoir, Locked in the Cabinet, is about. Reich served as Secretary of Labor during Bill Clinton's first term. They knew each other from their days as Rhodes Scholars at Oxford University. Before joining the cabinet, Reich lectured on political economy at Harvard and had written several books on economic matters, arguing that the United States had to invest more in education, job training, and our infrastructure. He moved to Washington with his wife, who had taken a leave of absence from her job directing a domestic violence institute, and their two children. Shortly before the 96 presidential election, Reich informed the president that he was leaving the cabinet and returning to Boston. I asked Reich why.
Terry, I have a family, a wonderful wife, and I have two teenage boys who... I don't know if you have teenage boys or how many of your listeners have teenage boys, and I don't know what teenage girls are like, but their teenage boys are like clamshells. They open up just for a moment, and then they clam shut again. And I wanted to be with them. They're only going to be home for a few more years, and it was so difficult for me sometimes, even though I loved the job more than I've ever loved any job, and I'm sure it will be the best job I've ever had in my life. It's the best family I've ever had or will ever have in my life, and I just simply could not do the job anymore.
Now, I'm with you completely on this, and yet there's a voice in my head saying, well, that's the diplomatic reason that he left. There must be other reasons, too.
That's the real reason. That's the 100% reason. I struggled with it. I knew in the weeks preceding the 96 election that the president was going to be reelected. The polls showed it. The public seemed to be there with him. And that meant that I was going to have to make a decision, and I put off the decision. Claire and Adam and Sam, the two boys, they had gone back home because Claire had a job that required her to be back there. I was commuting on weekends back and forth from Washington to Boston every weekend. And although, again, the issues were exciting, we raised the minimum wage and we were attacking sweatshops and we were really making progress, I found myself just miserable. And I didn't do it for them. I mean, I think they could have gone on with their dad in Washington most of the week, but I needed them. I found that I really did not want to get to the point where they left home and I was not with them, and I didn't have memories of being with them.
Well, a lot of Washington politicians talk about family values, but you say Washington really hates families.
I think Washington, there are references in my book to the kinds of the grueling schedules that Washington imposes on people. And although people try to have a good family life in Washington, I'm talking about high government officials, people at the pinnacles of power, it is very, very difficult. Claire and Adam and Sam were not terribly impressed with Washington. When we first went down to Washington, I desperately wanted the boys to feel very good about leaving their school and their friends and coming down to a new school and new friends. And we went and I arranged for them to meet the president. They had met him, Bill Clinton, that is, years before. They knew him, but they had not actually seen him as president. And we all got together in the Oval Office, and I was so excited for them. And they both shook hands with the president, and they posed for pictures behind his desk. And then we walked out, and the boys were absolutely silent. And I thought, they are dumbfounded. And we walked out of the White House and and up Pennsylvania Avenue, and they still didn't say anything. And I said, isn't it incredible? And Sam, who was then 8, said, it is absolutely incredible. It's incredible, Dad. And I said, well, you know, I'm Secretary of Labor, and that's your president. He said, no, it's incredible that there is not a single McDonald's in downtown Washington. Washington sucks. And he, there was no, the boys were not impressed. And I suppose that's a good thing.
You know, I was interested to read that you had a double hip replacement just before you became Secretary of Labor. And I'm always amazed, you know, like when presidents are just like getting out of anesthesia and then there's like signing bills from the hospital bed. I'm thinking, how can I comprehend anything? You feel horrible after surgery. Mm. I'm thinking there you are lying with these two, you know, hip replacements. And Clinton's like faxing you stuff, that policy stuff that you're supposed to be reading and
it was
passing
well,
judgment on. How do you do that? I've never understood it.
It was not a very, it was a difficult thing. The hip replacement is a very successful operation, and it was a wonderful operation. But there I was, and I was getting drafts of putting people first, which is the, you know, which was the major, and they were getting lost. You know, nurses were taking them home at night, and Bill Clinton was calling me on the phone and asking me questions, and it was difficult at that point in time.
Your successor, or your would-be successor, the woman who would like to be your successor, is undergoing her confirmation hearings now for Secretary of Labor. You write a little bit about how you were prepped for yours. What was the best advice you were given about how to handle yourself during the confirmation hearings?
They said to me repeatedly, be respectful, respond to their questions, but don't try to answer every question they have. You know, you're a professor, you've always tried to show people you knew what you were talking about, even when you didn't fully know what you're talking about. Don't do it. Say, I don't know, if you don't know. And that was a little hard for me, Terry. You know, you're sitting with congressmen, senators, who are, and it's a big, crowded, almost theatrical place, and there are cameras on you, and you have a chance to shine, to show the world that you know something, and you have to say, well, I don't know. If you don't really know, I don't fully know, Senator, or I'd look forward to working with you on that, Senator. Rather than getting into substantive conversations, disagreements, it really is a matter in those confirmation hearings of showing respect. Your respect for them, the executive branch, their respect for the legislative branch. You have to genuflect. It's about saluting. And that was a hard thing for me to learn.
One of your first actions in the position as Secretary of Labor was to close the executive dining room. Did you close it because of money, to save money?
No, I was feeling very strongly that here I was preaching to the private sector that it ought to reduce hierarchies and its executives ought to be treating employees as assets. And I was telling executives they ought to close their private dining rooms and get rid of their perks. Well, I thought we ought to live the same way in the Labor Department. And so I closed the executive dining room. It was easy to do, Terry, because there weren't any executives there yet. You can get away with doing something
right,
like that before they're executives. And I ate in the employee cafeteria. But it proved to be a mixed blessing, because there I was standing in a very long line with my little plastic tray and my utensils, waiting for what seemed like an eternity to get up to the cashier. And I thought to myself, the first day I stood in line, I thought, you know, this is not the best use of a cabinet member's time. Maybe my egalitarian zealotry has gone a little bit too far.
Yeah, so what was your conclusion? You know, is it better for you to save your time and perhaps be a little elitist, or to be more populist and end up spending more time waiting online for your salad than you have time to meet with the vice president?
I think in the over the long term, I tilted in favor of standing in line, both literally and also figuratively. I thought it was important, for example, to travel coach class when a cabinet member goes into an airplane. I did. And there was always somebody, believe it or not, always somebody who said to me, you know, we really appreciate your traveling coach. And it was a little bit of an encumbrance because I had some security people with me and I had a lot of papers I had to read and everything. But I think that people are extremely sensitive to anybody with power, particularly anybody in government, leading or enjoying any extravagancies at all. And so maybe I went overboard. I probably did go overboard, but I think it was important.
What was your biggest misconception about what your life would be like as Secretary of Labor and what you'd be able to achieve?
Well, I was very impatient. Even though I'd worked in Washington before, I wanted to get there and immediately create jobs and better jobs, education and training opportunities, and immediately raise the minimum wage and attack sweatshops and reform pensions. And I had to learn patience. I had to learn that most of what happens in Washington is not a matter of making decisions. It's a matter of managing problems and pushing, very, very gradually, pushing decision-making forward. I also had to grapple with a Washington that was moving away from my values, moving to the right. By 1994, a resurgent Republican Congress, very conservative, and some of them quite mean-spirited. And I don't mean this, it's going to sound, obviously, quite biased of me, and perhaps it is. The book is filled with my biases, because that's who I mean, everybody has biases. But people used to shout at me. I used to come for congressional hearings and sit there and have some Republicans, after 1994, in the 104th Congress, just scream at me, call me a communist, or tell me, you know, that I was being dishonest, question my integrity. And I had all I could do to try to maintain my composure, not get sucked into a shouting match, not be angry, separate myself from the job, keep a sense of humor, keep a sense of proportion. Cabinet jobs are glamorous temp jobs. They're nothing more. I knew I was going home. I was going to do the best job I could, but I was going home eventually.
Now, you write about how it was difficult sometimes to criticize the Clinton administration because they were your people. You don't want to criticize your own team in public too much. So in a way, it was a little easier when the so-called Republican Revolution happened because this was your opposition. You could criticize them. But then you were told by your aides that you shouldn't criticize Newt Gingrich and company so overtly because then they'd make you a target and therefore your programs would be targets too and it would be harder to get anything done.
Yes, they were worried. Was that
true? I mean, do you think that that's good advice?
To some extent, it was true and it was good advice. I was out there, pretty far out there on corporate welfare. You know, I gave a speech coining that neologism and people were very upset about that, both inside the White House and also on Capitol Hill, many Republicans. I was on the firing line, on the front line, on many issues, and my staff said, now, wait a minute, if you're going to take that much heat, if you're going to be the president's point man, you have to understand that there's going to be a penalty here. We may not get as much money as we want in our appropriation for summer jobs, for disadvantaged kids, for example, or for training programs for welfare mothers or for any other things. They may take it out on us. And I was... Well, that to me, that just seemed incomprehensible, that I would be disciplined by the other side for speaking out. But to some extent, it did happen.
My guest is Robert Reich. He's written a memoir about serving as Secretary of Labor during President Clinton's first term. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Reich is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his 4 years as Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, and the memoir is called Locked in the Cabinet. You had several disagreements with President Clinton. First of all, let's talk about what those biggest disagreements were. What were they?
I think welfare was probably the only real sharp, clear disagreement. Now, I work for him. He was elected, is elected. I wasn't. I was very aware of the fact that we... I could at most disagree. I could give him my advice. I could tell him what I thought he needed to do. But that was the end of it. He had to make the ultimate decision. I was quite upset by Dick Morris, the advisor who came on in 1995 and through the election. I was upset because I despised what he stood for. It seemed to me he had no moral compass. It was all just about getting reelected. And Morris and I would have very tough discussions, and I would ask him or suggest that he do something or advise the president to do something differently, and he'd say, look, my job, Bob, my job is to get the president elected. Your job is to advise the president what he can do once he's reelected or while he has power, but don't tell me my job. My job is to get him reelected. I know how to do that. And then I'd argue back, but Dick, if we don't have a mandate after 1996 for doing the kind of things that are important for this country, then what good is it to have him reelected? And we go around and around on that.
In your book, you call Dick Morris Mephistopheles, the corrupter, the ultimate betrayer, and you say he represents all that you detest in American politics.
Well, that's very, I suppose,
harsh?
It is harsh.
Maybe.
It is
it's
harsh.
It's a strong word.
Yeah, that's. It's not a mean book, but that's how I felt.
Well, he, among other things, wanted to test your positions in polls.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to do opinion polls on your positions. What troubled you about that?
Because you can't lead through opinion polls. Opinion polls, first of all, register how people feel about something that they haven't really thought about very much. But presidents or any other leaders of society have to lead people. They have to provide people with visions and ideas and arguments. And then if people feel differently, that's one thing. But to use opinion polls as a metric for where you ought to go is like a dog chasing its tail. You end up going ultimately nowhere. And Dick Morris was especially mindful and sensitive to what he called the swing, the suburban swing, the people who had not made up their minds, who were not clearly in the Clinton retinue, but also not clearly in the opponent's side. That was before Dole had emerged as the clear front runner, although Dole was kind of used as a surrogate in polling for who the other side's front runner would be. And he would only focus on the suburban swing. Well, if you're only focusing on the suburban swing, you're leaving out a lot of America, and a lot of America that may ultimately not vote if they feel that there's no reason to vote or there's nothing in it for them. And indeed, we saw a lot of working people did not vote this past presidential election. They just many of them shrugged their shoulders and said, why should I?
Do you feel that President Clinton abandoned his own ideas, his own vision, by chasing political polls?
Well, he didn't have to take, and to some extent did not take, Dick Morris's advice. Dick Morris was one of his advisors. There were others. But certainly to the extent that the president simply went after the suburban swing, and I don't know even to this day, Terry, whether him signing, his decision to sign the welfare bill was motivated primarily by those kinds of considerations or by more principled considerations. But to the extent that he did follow the polls and only the polls, I think that that is a failure of leadership.
Well, say President Clinton hadn't signed the welfare bill and he wasn't reelected. Would you have felt maybe Dick Morris was right? I mean, do you think it's worth it to have your man reelected, even if it entails some compromising?
Well, that's a very central, very good question. A president obviously appoints the judges of the United States, federal court system, Supreme Court judges, justices. Who is in the White House matters a great deal. But on the other hand, if you are compromising principles, if it's all means and not ends, then what difference does it make? Why be there? Why have that authority? And there is and I've debated it in my head constantly, is it better to be a one-term president or cabinet official and stand up for what you believe, and stand up hard and strong for what you believe, even if that means that you won't be there after 4 years?
Did a lot of people tell you it's easy for you to say that because you're an appointee?
Oh, yes.
And you're
yes.
not,
and
you're
I
not
told
an
my,
elected
but,
official.
I told myself that all the time. You know, politics, as the old saying goes, politics is the art of the possible. I was not a politician. I thanked Lord, the Lord that I wasn't a politician. You know, I'm name-challenged. I can't remember people's names. I would walk into meetings or receptions, and I would go blank. You know, I would be the worst politician in the world. Heaven help us if I were a politician. And I'm also very shy. I try not to show it. I reveal it in the book. But I didn't go to dinner parties in Washington. I didn't socialize. Claire was not, certainly didn't like the Washington scene. Washington is a, you know, if you can measure the size of a town by the velocity of gossip, Washington is a very tiny Midwestern town with one little main street. Everybody works for the same company or against the same company or lobbies the same company or reports on the same company. It's a one-company town. And it can get very, very insular, very boring. I wasn't very good at it. I wasn't elected, and I kept telling myself, you're just a visitor here.
When you disagreed with President Clinton, how public would you make that disagreement?
Oh, I wouldn't make it public. No, that was absolutely forbidden. Sometimes the press got wind.
Forbidden by who?
Forbidden by my conscience. Remember, the president put me in this position. Whatever power and authority I had, whatever influence I had, was as a result of his decision to appoint me. And for me to turn around while I had that authority, while I had that power, and to use it against him would be, I think, betrayal. It would be disloyal. I owed it to him to give him my best shot, to tell him exactly what I believed, and to argue as hard as I possibly could argue. And I did. Believe me, I did. And I argued with my colleagues in the cabinet. Sometimes there were cabinet meetings or economic advisor meetings where it was everybody yelling at me and me yelling at everybody else. But, you know, that was my job, and I was going to do that. But I was not going to go public with my disagreements.
Robert Reich's new memoir is called Locked in the Cabinet. He's now a professor at Brandeis University. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Robert Reich on his 4 years as Secretary of Labor in the administration of his old friend, Bill Clinton. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new HBO telemovie In the Gloaming, directed by Christopher Reeve. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Reich. His new memoir, Locked in the Cabinet, is about his 4 years as Secretary of Labor during President Clinton's first term. Reich and Clinton were old friends. They met when they were Rhodes Scholars at Oxford University. Shortly before Clinton's re-election, Reich decided to return home to Boston. During your 4 years in the Clinton administration, the president was facing a lot of problems. And now, for instance, now there's the fundraising scandals. There was Whitewater when you were still in the administration, sex scandals surrounding the president. I'm interested in your take on these. Let's start with the fundraising scandals now. Do you see this as a terrible problem and a terrible embarrassment or something that's being overplayed?
I think that the whole way in which we finance campaigns is a scandal. What's a scandal is not what is illegal, but like so much else, what's a scandal is what's legal. The extraordinary amount of money flowing into presidential campaigns. Washington, over the 4 years I was there, was a very imbalanced place. The people with money and with power in the private sector were able, Democrats, Republicans, executive branch, legislative branch, whatever, they were able to get a hearing in a way that average working people simply were not able to get a hearing. Money counts. I remember even at the Democratic Convention, it almost was as if, and I relate this, there were different conventions going on simultaneously. There was the Democratic Convention with the delegates on the floor, but then there was the Financial Convention, the people in the skyboxes who had hors d'oeuvres and shrimp and cocktails and could watch it all through their skybox windows. They were the big ticket. They were the big contributors. They did not mix with others on the floor. And I think it's just very dangerous for our democracy.
Do you think that the Clinton administration or the Democratic Party did anything seriously wrong in their fundraising techniques?
I don't know the answer to that, Terry. I know that Dick Morris did, beginning really early in 95, as soon as I began meeting with him and he with me and others, he wanted the president to have ads on television, commercials on television, campaign commercials, and that required a huge amount of money. Republicans already were outspending Democrats and did collect in the election almost twice as much money as the Democrats. And that may have required that the Democratic National Committee bend some rules and sort of cut some corners. But again, the scandal is not those technicalities. The scandal is the system itself. And that must be, absolutely must be reformed.
You know President Clinton as a man, as a friend, not just as a president. When there were stories about his sex life and allegations about his sex life, I'm just wondering what it was like for you, because you probably know a lot about his personal life, and I guess I'm wondering in part how much of a man's personal life who is president do you think should be public? How much should it matter whether they really had an affair or not? Assuming that the charges and harassment, you know.
Yeah. First of all, I did know the president and the first lady, have known them for 30 years, mm-hmm. Did not have any knowledge of any of their personal difficulties, if they did have personal difficulties in their marriage. My view is if it is relevant, and you just put your finger on it, if it has to do with, say, a charge of sexual harassment or something like that, that might be relevant to have somebody does their job. But if it's purely personal, and it has no relevance to how the public can expect them to carry out their duties, I don't think that really is something that ought to be discussed. I think there is a realm of privacy. We should respect that privacy. You know, countless times over the 4 years, I would look at the two of them, and I'd see simultaneously my old friends, people who I'd known for 30 years, and we had gone to graduate school with, and I had met Bill Clinton on the boat going to Oxford. We were both going over on scholarships. And I see them simultaneously, and then I suddenly see the First Lady and the President and the people who hold this extraordinary office, the hopes and the fears and the anger of 260 million Americans. And it was an amazing thing to see the two of them transposed that way. When Claire had to go back to Boston for her work.
Is your wife?
Yes. The president, the first lady, Bill and Hillary, took us out to dinner. And it was the first time in several years that we had been back to the way we were before. And we went into Kincaid's, which is a very classy restaurant north of the White House, northwest of the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. And we just walked in. We had Secret Service with us, but we just walked in. And none of the diners, I was amazed, I have this in the book, none of the people who were sitting there looked up. They just, you know, he was the president walking in with the first lady and friends, but they just went on dining. And we went off to a private dining room, and we had a wonderful meal, and then came out again. And obviously word had got out. Maybe they just, most of the diners there had just not noticed. But they all stood up, and they applauded as we came out of the private dining room. And then we went out on the street, and there were spotlights, Clegg lights, and cameras, and 200 people had gathered. And it was almost as if our friends from years ago had suddenly been transformed back into royalty. I wrote, it's almost like a reverse Cinderella. A clock chimes midnight, and we're back, Claire and I, my wife and I, back as members of the royal court. They're back as members of royalty. They're back as president. It's no longer the same people we knew.
Hmm. How'd you like being a member of the royal court? I mean, how did you like getting the applause as you left the restaurant?
Well, there's certainly it's heady and exhilarating to be a member of the royal court. Sometimes it was a little bit frustrating. I mean, we'd have these. I would be summoned to go out to summits, you know, like the Forest Summit or the Economic Summit, and sit there at a table with the president and with cameras and so on. But I was really a stage prop, and I often imagined that it would be much cheaper for the taxpayers if there were simply a cardboard cutout of me looking quite intently at the president, very serious, that I could ship out to the on those occasions. And stay back in Washington doing real work.
You've been a teacher most of your life. And you went from teaching at Harvard to being Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. A lot of people say, well, you know, professors, it's easy for them to criticize what happens in politics because they're just in their ivory tower. Did you find that you actually had to revise any of your thoughts, any of your proposals, once you were in the middle of the more pragmatic aspects of politics?
Oh, sure. Now, I had been in Washington in the 1970s, so I wasn't a complete stranger to this, but never at the level, obviously, that I was operating, Terry. And I had, for 12 years, been writing books and making all kinds of recommendations and criticizing politicians for not doing this or doing that, and now I was there, and I had nobody to blame but me. Yes, it's more difficult to get things done. The press is more difficult to deal with. There is a gotcha mentality in Washington. I was amazed the day we signed into law the school to work apprenticeship law, which created and has created millions of school to work apprenticeships for young people who may not go on to college. That day, I expected the press to be turned out in mass, and I expected headlines the next day about all of the, you know, finally we have a school-to-work apprenticeship system. There was not a single article written about it, not a single press account. And yet, other days when the press got word of a little bit of a spat between me and Secretary Benson or Secretary Rubin, it would make headlines. And I was amazed. Why is it that the public doesn't hear about things that I think are so important, such triumphs, and yet this little gossipy nonsense makes the front page? Well, obviously the answer is that the press wants to sell papers, and confrontation is exciting. And good news, the fact that everybody comes together and passes a piece of legislation, that's not very exciting. That's not a good spectator sport.
What are some of the ideas that you changed when you actually became Secretary of Labor? Things that sounded good from Harvard but didn't sound so good in Washington?
Well, my ideals, I don't think, I hope they have not changed, and my values. But, for example, there was one idea that I had managed to convince the president-elect was a good idea, and it got into putting people first. And even there in my hospital bed, and as I had my hips replaced, I was editing that. And it was to require that companies, all companies, devote at least 1.5% of their payrolls to training their workers. And if they were not going to do that, to put that money into a central fund to train others. I thought that was a pretty good idea. But when I got to Washington, I was met by to call it a chorus understates it, just an overwhelming, screaming mob of people, most in the business community, saying you can't do that because that is just impractical. There's no way of keeping those kinds of records. Who is going to determine whether we've spent 1.5%? It will be a nightmare, just an informational nightmare. And I talked to people in the Treasury, and they said you can't keep track of that. It would create endless litigation. The courts would be filled. Try it some other way. It was that kind of very practical, not just the political opposition, but also implementation. Listen, you professorial big shot, you know, how do you actually plan to get this implemented in detail, in just practical detail? And I had to spend a lot of my time over 4 years at that level of very, very minute detail, which as a professor, you don't have to. You can sit in your tower and think big.
My guest is Robert Reich. He's written a memoir about serving as Secretary of Labor during President Clinton's first term. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, and he's just written a new memoir called Locked in the Cabinet about his 4 years in the Clinton administration. Your new book, your memoir, is based on a journal that you kept while you were in the cabinet. And I'm almost surprised that anyone in the cabinet would keep a journal now, because I'd imagine a lot of people would be fearful that it's going to be subpoenaed.
Well, there was that fear, but I was sort of out of the direct firing line with regard to anything that was going on with Whitewater. And I said to myself, look, I'm a writer. I don't know about you, but many people, and I think probably, Terry, listening to you, you're the same way. In order to think through what is happening to you, often you have to write things down in order to understand this extraordinary experience, being a cabinet member, having all of these, some very humorous, very funny, weird things happened, and I needed it. At midnight, I would often go in and write things down in a journal. Not a diary. I would sometimes skip weeks, but then some hilarious thing would happen. I just had to get it down, or I had to get a little piece of dialogue down. I had to remember it. There's just no way I would remember otherwise.
Did you ever feel like you were becoming a monster because of the demands that were being made?
I did, and I had to, and I think anybody in this situation has to constantly reiterate, this is just a temp job. Keep your sense of humor. Find humor in this. Keep your distance from this. If they attack you, they're not really attacking you as a person. They're attacking what you did in this job. They're attacking the Secretary of Labor. Don't take it personally. Try to stay centered. Try to stay balanced. It's hard, Terry. It's really, really hard. Sometimes you want to scream. Sometimes I was on television and somebody asked me a silly question and I wanted to say, that is the stupidest, dumbest asked question I ever heard. How can you ask that, you jerk? Or sometimes something funny would happen and I would be in a public setting and I'd want to just roar and I couldn't stop laughing, but I had to control that. Or very often I was scared. You know, it's like walking across a minefield sometimes, because you knew that at any time there are 18,000 employees in the Department of Labor, a budget of $35 billion. And if something goes wrong, if there's a scandal, if there's just something that for some reason gets on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times, that's really awful, I'm going to blow up. And you don't know, you know, you try to do your best, but anything can happen anytime, and you live with that. So there is that terror. But I couldn't express terror. I couldn't say to anybody, you know, I am absolutely terrified today. I don't even want to get up. It's so, this is frightening. You can't do that.
Because you can't show weakness?
You can't show weakness. You can't show weakness partly because the people who are your opponents politically seize on weakness. But you also can't show weakness because you have employees who want you and need you to be strong. You need to be something of a father figure. You need to be a leader, a cheerleader, a coach. And you have a public that wants to be confident that its national leaders are not frightened and three-dimensional and really don't have quite the sense of humor they really do. I think if I had expressed myself fully, as I do in this book, when I was Secretary of Labor, a lot of people would scratch their heads and say, who is that guy? Why is he in office? Do we really want him there? Maybe they wouldn't. I don't know.
Some people are very physically imposing, and they use that to help them get power, to get power over other people. And you're very short. You're under 5 feet. And so you couldn't rely on that sense of being physically imposing to intimidate an opponent or to gain control of a room in a rebellious situation.
I certainly couldn't. One time, actually, I was in a meeting that was getting completely out of control, and there were some Republicans there, including Alan Simpson, who's 6'7". And I wanted to talk to him and yell at him, but we're very good friends. So I pulled up a chair, a folding chair, and I stood on it in the center of this meeting, and it put me just about at his head level. And we had a wonderful, almost raucous conversation, but there I was, you know, 2.5 feet off the ground. It was important to make people comfortable with my height, so that I had to use humor sometimes. The first time when the president announced that I was going to join his cabinet, I was then, after his announcement, to come up to the podium. I was supposed to come up to the podium. There were a lot of cameras. National television was there. And his podium comes up to his chest, but it comes up to my nose. And nobody had thought, I certainly hadn't thought, to put a little stool behind the podium. So I came up to the podium. The national press was there. And all they could see was my eyes and the top of my head. And I was embarrassed. I thought, well, my goodness, you know, the people at home, they're going to wonder what the bottom half of my face looks like. This is ridiculous. But then I said, this is an honor for me to become a nominee to be Secretary of Labor, but I always knew I was on Bill Clinton's short list.
Oh, please.
I needed to do something, Terry, to break the ice or to make people feel a little less awkward about the situation.
One last question. This is a family thing. You say you left the cabinet because your wife and your sons had moved back to Boston so that your wife could resume her work because her leave of absence had expired. And you wanted to be with your family. Now that you're reunited and you're no longer Secretary of Labor, have the rules in the household changed? I mean, when you were Secretary of Labor, there's probably a lot you could get out of doing, saying, look, you know, the President of the United States is relying on me to get this other job done, so I can't do the dishes, I can't take, you know, my son to the softball game or whatever. Yeah.
The first day I was home for good, I looked around the house. There were a lot of things needed to be done. I mean, just mowing and raking and things had piled up. And I did something that, looking back on, is really very funny, and I'm kind of ashamed of it. I wrote a memo.
To who?
to me and to Claire, my wife, and to the boys, and said, well, these are the kinds of things we really need to get done, and let's develop a timetable. And they still, 3 months later, will not let me forget this. I mean, they have this memo, and they just dump on me constantly for this. Obviously, I am taking out the garbage, and I am I'm walking the dogs. One of the problems one faces, it's not decompression. I don't have a problem decompression. I don't have the bends. It's staff deprivation. There's nobody around to delegate anything to. There's nobody around, and and I have to do it. Somebody said on the phone the other day, can you fax that to me? And I said, oh, sure. And I hung up the phone and said, well, now, wait a minute. I have to fax something. And there's this marvelous, and it really is a marvelous, it's not bad, it's a marvelous process of regaining responsibility for yourself.
Quick question. You had an aide whose goal was to teach you how to be a muckety-muck, how to shake hands for only like 5 seconds per hand so you can move on to another person, how to walk through an airport with great assurance and give your baggage to an aide to carry, you know, the kind of stuff like really important people do, muckety-mucks. I don't know how well you mastered that, but is that stuff that you intend to keep doing now that you're no longer in a muckety-muck position?
My family will not allow me to be a muckety-muck at home, elsewhere. They have demucked me very, very quickly. I was amused about that. I was amused at that lesson. He was very serious about it, by the way, that aide, about how to become a muckety-muck. And those principles I wrote down that night because I just thought they were hilarious. But above all, he said, be cool. Don't let anybody know or see that you are worried about anything. A muck is always in command. A muck is above the fray. And let your arms swing freely, walk quickly, look important. And I'm afraid I'm back to what I was before. I'm just another person.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And good luck with your new life back home.
Thanks.
Robert Reich's new memoir is called Locked in the Cabinet. He's now a professor at Brandeis University. Coming up, a new telemovie directed by Christopher Reeve. This is Fresh Air. Sunday night on the HBO telemovie In the Gloaming, Glenn Close stars as a wife and mother whose grown son is dying of AIDS. He returns home to live out the remainder of his life. The movie is directed by Christopher Reeve, who helmed the project despite his severe spinal cord injury. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
By now, you've probably encountered some of the publicity regarding Christopher Reeve as director of In the Gloaming. How he chose this particular piece, adapted by Will Sheffer from a New Yorker short story by Alice Elliott Dark, because it involved only a few locations and a handful of characters. How he directed from the next room, watching on a TV monitor, so the sounds of his breathing apparatus wouldn't be picked up by the microphones. How he, in turn, would guide his actors by having his voice piped into the next room, like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. No question, there's a lot of drama behind the scenes of In the Gloaming. But it's the drama on screen that counts. And on that level, In the Gloaming is so good, and its acting so credible and subtle, there's no way to dismiss or downplay Reeve's contributions as a director. The cast is tremendous. Robert Sean Leonard of Dead Poets Society plays Danny, the young gay man who's coming home for the last months of his life. The symbolic title In the Gloaming refers to that final moody hour before sunset. Featured in small supporting roles are David Strathairn from The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd as Danny's distant father, Bridget Fonda as his resentful sister, and Whoopi Goldberg as the live-in nurse hired as Danny's condition worsens. And carrying the brunt of the drama and the movie is Glenn Close as Danny's mom in a performance that will be the one to beat at next year's Emmy Awards. You don't get acting this good across the board without a gifted director doing the orchestrating. So much is conveyed in the pauses and the glances and the body language, and you can't get the full effect of that from hearing an excerpt. But you get enough to know it's something really special. Listen to this scene featuring Close and Leonard in which a mother-son chat about sex on film leads to something much more personal.
I've been wondering, that side of your life, you know, was it satisfying for you? With Paul?
Don't tell me you're finally asking me about my sex life.
No, I'm asking about your love life.
Oh, my love life.
No, I'm serious. Did you love? Were you loved in return?
Yes.
Good.
Shucks, that was easy.
I'm getting very easy in my old age.
Really, maybe you should let Dad in on that little secret.
Don't be fresh.
You started it.
Well, now I'm going to stop it.
It's hard to look at In the Gloaming and not think back to an early Frost, television's first AIDS-related movie. That was a dozen years ago, back in 1985. And that story, like this one, was about a gay son coming home with AIDS to die and to reach out to a frightened but loving mother and a stiffly distant father. One significant change, though, is that An Early Frost was as much an instructional film as a drama. Back then, a lot of exposition was devoted to the definitions and symptoms of HIV and AIDS, and how the virus could and could not be transmitted. In Gloaming, we see sarcoma without explanation. Knowledge and awareness are presumed. Only the drama remains. And in HBO's In the Gloaming, there's plenty of it, on screen as well as off. Don't miss it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. In the Gloaming airs this Sunday on HBO. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Alan Tu directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publishers of The 9 Steps to Financial Freedom from certified financial planner Susie Orman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Bad Taste. In celebration of the 25th anniversary of the midnight movie classic Pink Flamingos, the film has been re-released. We'll feature interviews with the director, John Waters, and the star, Divine, who died in 1988. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.